You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. For this episode, have the pleasure and the privilege of talking to Jessica McDermott, who wrote a very important book, study, piece of investigative journalism called The Highway of Tears, which inquires into the tragedies of missing and murdered Indigenous women in British Columbia. And that book came out last year, and we're lucky enough to have her on the podcast to talk about that book and also to talk to her about her art and her craft and investigative journalism. Jessica McDermott, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Ken.
It's great to chat with you. I did some research and just saw, you know, your works in research around the world in the continent of Africa. And of course, as I mentioned, the Highway of Tears book. But before we get into some of the recent things that you've written, can you describe what you were like when you were younger? I mean, were you always interested in investigating things, or you have a curious mind?
Yeah, I think that would be fair to say. I was certainly always a writer. I think my brother he's a couple years older, so he'd gone to kindergarten, and I think I could kind of read and write by then, but I would like hassle him when he got home from kindergarten to teach me everything that he'd learned, because I was just desperate to be able to read and write. So I was a pretty precocious little kid, and was writing novels by the time I was seven or so. They were all about wild horses and evil farmers that would trap the wild horses to sell them to meat markets. And then inevitably there was a young heroine that would rescue the wild horses and then ride them out into, you know, the wilds and live with the wild horses forever.
those books sound fantastic.
You know, my mom actually dug one of them out probably 10 years ago, but I had finished journalism school by then, and you know, I was working as a reporter and maybe feeling a little discouraged, or like my work had become very much the work of a newspaper reporter and the art part of it had disappeared, and she had dug it out, and I was almost heartbroken, because I was like, look at what I was doing when I was like so little, and now what am I doing? My life is over. I failed. And, you know, in the way that I often thought at 24.
Yeah, sure. And so let's chat about that a little bit. I mean, so you saw this huge, you know, artistic, creative, kind of expansive, maybe younger version or vision of, you know, what you were creating. And then, you know, maybe comparing it to a little bit more of I'd imagine some of the difficult work and digging into details and investigating and trying to put this together. What did that moment mean to you? I mean, did it end up informing your approach to your work, to your investigative writing?
Well, I think I've always been looking for the place between the two ideas, one of which started off where I wanted to be a novelist. I wanted to write beautiful fiction, and then ended up in a career in journalism. And that was largely because I think in my sort of early mid-teens, I got more interested in world events, in history, in sociology, and in what was going on around me outside my dreams of running away with wild horses. And I was appalled by what I saw, to be frank. I started learning about things like, you know, proxy wars during the Cold War, and just how could this be happening? How could this be happening over and over and nobody cares? And it was with, you know, all the rage of a 14 or 15 year old. And it was through that I came across a book I think to put my mom in an interview twice, she'll love this. She had gotten me a book from a Chapters bookstore bargain bin, which was written by a foreign correspondent, Canadian foreign correspondent named Oakland Ross, called A Fire on the Mountain. And it was sort of a personal account of many of the global conflicts that he had covered as a reporter. And I was incredibly inspired. It really, quite literally, sort of changed my view on everything. And I was like, foreign correspondent, this is the way to go. So then there was, you know, the long path trying to get there, which ends up being feeling often not very literary or artistic. You know, you work for a city news desk and you get sent out on an assignment and you have 8 inches to shove in the basic information and that's sort of it. But that was, you know, what I learned was that was incredible training because you have to become really gymnastic with your words. You don't, I realize now looking back, I wrote very long and very flowery and not all that clearly. And so as uncomfortable as it was to, you know, sort of have somebody take a red pen to 2/3 of what you had just done, it gave me this incredible awareness of words that I had never had and this precision with them. And then, you know, fast forward again, when I was so lucky to get to the point where I could do a book, I'm not saying I think I succeeded necessarily, but I wanted to combine those two things. So combine, you know, a literary approach, trying to write something that in places is, you know, beautiful writing combined with a lot of information and facts and, you know, the sort of idea of shining a light on wrongdoing in hopes that it will be solved and put those two together into one place. So my ideal would be, you know, to be a literary investigative journalist. And it's a road that I'm on. I don't think I'm there yet. But, you know, maybe by book 3 or 4, I'll look at it and go, wow, you did it.
Well, yeah, and I can see, you know, and thanks for describing some of you thinking about that. I have an episode coming out pretty soon with a writer in Oregon, Benjamin Gorman, and I found it quite interesting, and I've had writers on the podcast to talk about those artistic choices, to talk about the tensions that, you know, that appear in writing. So I want to thank you for, you know, talking about those components. And it, just out of curiosity, in addition to, you know, the importance of writing and as far as art forms, are there any other art forms that are significant to you as far as what you enjoy?
I mean, in terms of what I do and what I'm good at, I'm totally a one-trick pony. It's writing. But I love pretty much all art. I mean, I love music. It's a huge part of my life. I've dabbled badly in many instruments. And, you know, I always say I'm an enthusiast, not a musician. I'm an enthusiast. And I really appreciate other people's music. Kim, for example, who I know you'll speak to. Same thing with photography. You know, I've dabbled in it. I go through periods where I get really into it. And then it sort of disappears again. And then recently, like painting and more sort of visual art has become a huge interest. I mean, mainly because of a fellow that I know who does sort of impressionist or abstract art. And he did some paintings of New Orleans and Louisiana, which is one of my favorite places ever. And I just love them so much. And so that's becoming a new interest.
Yeah. And well, you are certainly a writer if you love New Orleans that much, right? New Orleans, that's a place for writers. It's a writer's place.
I went there in 2005 for like summer or spring break during university. And they had been, you know, giving credit cards to students in the student union building. So they gave me one, which was, you know, had long lasting repercussions, but it meant that I got to go to New Orleans for a week and just completely fell in love with it. And I've been back many times. I moved there for a period of time and it's somewhere I'll always go back to.
That's great to hear. And thanks for sharing that. So let's talk about Highway of Tears, right? Can you tell the listeners about, you know, what led you to the story, in just how you entered into this project and what your book Highway of Tears, what it is?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was led to the story because I grew up in the middle of it. I grew up in a town called Smithers, which is about halfway along what's now referred to as the Highway of Tears, which itself is about 450 miles of, you know, single lane highway through a really remote area in Western Canada. So growing up, this was something that happened. There was several girls that went missing from my hometown. There was girls that went missing from the surrounding towns. And so it was always there. And I think a friend of mine actually recently had told me that I was talking about this when she met me, which was when I was 19. I was saying, somebody's got to write a book about it. Somebody's got to do something about it. So it was there for a long time. And in my mid-20s, I'd gone home for a visit with my family that still lived there in the summertime. And I was going to do all the research I needed to do a book on it then. This might have been the same trip that I read the first novel I'd ever written. And maybe that was the motivation. But I did some interviews with some of the players. I met some of the families. But I realized pretty quickly that I wasn't able to do. I didn't have the skills. I didn't have the maturity. I certainly didn't have the time or the resources. But I stayed in touch with people. I kept following it for years and years after, as I went and did all sorts of other things and grew up a lot. And then reached a point where I was able to go back and do it. So that's what I did. And, you know, the book itself really is, it's an exploration of what's happened there, which is, you know, more than a dozen Indigenous women and girls have gone missing from these really small, remote towns. And there's been very little response from the public, from the police, from the government. None of these cases have been solved. And, you know, so that's going back over 30 years. And so an examination of that and of the question of how does this happen? You know, who's responsible? What needs to be done? How do we prevent this from happening again? What do we do about the fact that it's still happening all across Canada? I mean, in that region specifically, the last year I was working on the book, there were 3 Indigenous women and girls who went missing. And then across Canada, across the United States, this is an ongoing, you know, genocide. And we're not taking the sort of action that we should be.
And I know in having listened to some of your interviews and having listened to the book that there's a lot of, you know, even accessing information, accurate information about the, you know, the true scope of the problem and statistics and getting reports is extremely difficult. And I heard you describe the kind of the cultural differences of, you know, the public's response to different races or groups of people when they go missing, in Indigenous women, those issues being ignored by, you know, maybe a white girl, you know, who goes missing and, you know, family wants all the help they can, gets a lot of exposure and there's progress on it. That seems so blatant in the cases that I've read about through your book and in the United States. For you investigating this, what was your response or how deeply frustrating was it to see that, just that disparate treatment in those cases?
Oh, incredibly frustrating. Like you want to pull your hair out and kick things. And it brought me back to being 15 and looking and saying, how could this happen? And, you know, that's for me a relative outsider. And for the families and friends and communities of these girls and women, it's atrocious. And it's still, you know, again, it's still going on now.
So one of the questions I have, and I'm asking a little bit in a way, just to explore this a bit more, is I've asked the question of, you know, what's the role of art? And I would just say, you know, your investigative work in your creation is a work of art, but, you know, the research, what is its role, art's role, you think, in disrupting, you know, the very racism that you're steeped in and having to report on it?
Yeah, I hope that shining a light on these things, presenting evidence to all the naysayers who say it's not racist here, we're not racist, it's not unequal, you know, art, writing and other art forms are a way of presenting that to hopefully chip away at the ongoing denial and apathy that still really pervades our society. I think it's also a way to help people understand and get a little, you know, beyond what might be the politics or the, you know, their prejudices, their lack of knowledge, their ignorance, to build a bit of a bridge there and show them that when they're making these comments or they're shuffling this stuff off, you know, what they're doing is awful because it's about other human beings. So when they say, oh, well, that girl should have taken responsibility for her actions, she shouldn't have been hitchhiking, you know, you tell that person the girl's story. This is a 15-year-old who was on her way to see her friends. And that seems to, that changes people. It has the potential to, anyway.
Yeah, and thanks for that too. We're speaking with Jessica McDermid, and for listeners, we did have a Something Rather Than Nothing podcast episode in the past with Rosalie Fish, which broached the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women in North America. And why Rosalie Fish, you know, who's a runner, was doing that. And of course, the protest symbol of the red paint on her face was something that was striking for me and actually caught my attention and brought me to greater awareness. And so now we have the great pleasure of speaking with Jessica McDermid, who, again, wrote the book Highway of Tears. And also have a nice correlation here, Jessica, I want to ask you about. After interviewing you, I'll be interviewing the incredibly gifted, wonderful artist, Kim Gucci, singer, and also created the design for the book cover. I was wondering if, just to make, you know, make that connection, can you talk about your work with Kim and how it relates to the book?
Sure. So I met Kim in 2016. There was a memorial walk down the length of the highway organized by Brenda Wilson, who's the sister of one of the murdered girls from Smithers. And so I walked the highway with Brenda and two other women, did the whole distance, and then in all the various communities, as people were able, available, they joined in. So on the last day, which was day 17, I believe, Brenda had put out a call for the last leg to have some volunteers come and cover some of the miles. So Kim had come with some friends and done that. So we had met then, and then stayed in contact, and she was coming to Smithers to play some musical events, and stayed at my mom's house where I was also living at the time, and they became friends. And over the years, you know, I was really honored to meet her mom, and we became close. And when it came time to, there was discussions about the cover of the book, I had felt really strongly for a long time that I wanted art, as opposed to so many stories about the Highway of Tears. You see the picture of the mountains and the lonely little road going through the forest, and I knew I didn't want that. And I thought that art by a local First Nations artist would be really spectacular. And I don't know that I even knew Kim really did much visual art. I mean, She was much more out there as a singer and songwriter. But she had brought a piece of artwork as a thank you to my mom for letting her stay one time. And I saw it and went, oh, wow.
Oh, and sure. Yeah.
Welled up courage for weeks. I was so scared to ask her. And then sent her like a shy little Facebook message and said, oh, you know, what do you think? Would you do this? And she said yes. And I was incredibly excited and honored. And then I only found this out recently, and she'll tell the story more, but we didn't really work together on what the art would be. She was in touch with the publisher and a designer for the publisher. And so I was sort of frantically going through edits and stuff, and they had this whole other process going on. And then I got the PDF of it. My editor sent it and said, you know, this is what they've come up with. What do you think? And I sat there and cried with happiness and sadness. And I mean, it's such a powerful image, and I was just so blown away.
It is a beautiful image. And thanks for sharing that. The book Highway of Tears, the cover, put together by Kim Gucci, will be a future guest on Something Rather Than Nothing. Truly a beautiful image, beautiful artwork. One question I ask all guests, Jessica, is what is art?
Interesting question. And it's really fun to actually get to talk about some of these things and, you know, think about them. So I put some thought into this because you had warned me. And, you know, I think it's a universal language. It's sort of like mathematics. It's a way that we can communicate and that we can reach across all the divides that we build up between us, you know, as we share and we reflect the world as we see it, and we absorb the world as other people see it. You know, and ultimately it's something that brings us together and makes us feel less alone in the world.
That's a powerful thing. Yeah, that's wonderful. I ask each guest that, and I think it's a fun one to answer, because I think everybody thinks about art, and then when they're reminded that they think so much about art, it kind of gives you permission to answer the question. I had mentioned to you, I think maybe before the podcast, how influenced I was by a book called The Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer. And it was just her kind of unabashed, if she felt she wanted to extend like the question and find out something, she would ask the question and just got beyond not asking the question, though it's not an easy process, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a little bit of bravery both in asking and answering questions, and I appreciate your indulgence in it.
I enjoyed thinking about it because I thought, you know, I get really wrapped up in day-to-day things and what I'm doing and what I'm working on. And so often there's not enough time where you're metaphorically or maybe literally wandering through a forest and looking at light coming through the trees and droplets of water on leaves and just letting your brain go and thinking, you know?
Yeah, that's the art part of it. It's good process, a healthy process. So, so Jessica, I wonder if you could just indulge me in just going back a bit, just to make sure we kind of convey a little bit more of the story of Highway of Tears in Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, MMIW, women and girls, of course. And I think it's a lot of people are learning about this, and I know there's been some swells of interest both in Canada and the United States at times, gauging from public awareness or interest that it's been growing and waning. I find it such an important and such a glaring issue that I haven't been able to look away from it since I encountered it. And so anytime I have a little bit of a space on the podcast to just kind of convey, you know, the story, I think it's worth it, even though it is a difficult one. One of the difficulties I'm sure you encountered in writing that book was, I believe you said that all the cases that you covered within the book are still unsolved. Is that correct?
Yeah. There's some that were never really included on the Highway of Tears list, though they took place in the area, that have been solved. But the ones that I focused on are all unsolved cases.
And amongst these cases, I mean, the book goes into depth and really personalizes both, you know, you make strong connections, Jessica, with the people that you're talking to, and you really do justice to the story, and a very difficult story to tell. But you make these connections. Now, in general, these are cases where, you know, girls, young women were, you know, just going somewhere, or maybe walking, or along this highway, this long stretch, and would simply disappear, and there wouldn't be much attention paid to it, or true investigation, or any of that process, pretty much with each of these cases. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, circumstances surrounding disappearances vary a lot, case by case, as does, I think, the investigations, though, as you pointed out, because they are still open investigations, they're not solved. We don't really know exactly what was or wasn't done. But generally speaking, yes.
And I thought structurally it was probably tough for you to tell the story, because you just had to tell what happened, and it's so caught up in, you know, frustrating, you know, manifestations of racism, of people not knowing, people not caring, and just trying to bring attention to these cases that were, you know, not solved or just not followed up upon. I really want to thank you, you know, for your courage in doing that work. And I know how difficult, because I'm sure you really wanted to get the story right. And as a reader, as far as what I know, I felt you got the story right and tried to honor, honor the story. I had a different question, and it's one I've asked guests recently. Can you mention who or what made you who you are now?
Yeah. I'm not sure who I am now. I am always changing. I think that's one of the many really exciting things about being alive, is that it's a journey. You never stop, and you never stop evolving. But to answer your question a little bit, actually answer it, you know, I think it's probably a mix of, I mean, certainly my family has had and has a profound impact on me. They're people who believe in right and wrong and believe in doing the right thing, sort of no matter the cost sometimes. You know, the principle is a really important thing, and also kindness and compassion and humility is a really important thing. I think the worst thing you could do in my family is ever talk highly about yourself. It's like a Scottish thing or Irish thing. You will get cut down in 5 seconds. But certainly my family. And then also, you know, they supported and encouraged my writing and my need to always be seeking and always be moving. You know, a lot of people when I was young, well, still now actually, but I left home quite young, did 1 year of university, and then that was boring, so I moved to Ireland, and then I went to university, and then I went to, you know, and I've sort of been bouncing all over the world as much as possible for my whole life, and nobody has ever said, you know, when are you going to settle down, or you're doing it wrong, or anything like that. There's always been huge support for my life adventures, and then also my pursuits in writing. And then I think experiences, you know, growing up, I read, as I've said, I read a ton, and largely a lot of my world was what I read. You know, I felt like authors were, who had been dead for 50 years, were my best friends and certainly my role models. And that was really informative when I was younger, and still is now. Though now I, you know, I can be out in the world and I actually know some writers and stuff like that, which, you know, you don't really when you're growing up in a very small town in northern BC. But yeah, I think those two factors are enormous. And then everything that you experience as you live changes you. And you know, I think I'm lucky to say so far, I feel like things, even, you know, bad things, increase my understanding of myself, but also other people. And I'm really, really grateful for that.
Yeah. And I think, in hearing you talk and talking about, you know, your family and the support that was there, I mean, I think it's just, it seems to me that that's just really pivotal. I've enjoyed that, and, you know, within my life, and, you know, where you have the support to discover, be whatever, you know, who you are and what path you want to follow, that can make a world of difference just as far as what you see as possible in the world. So I can hear how important that is to you.
It is, you know, and I do, and I so credit my parents. Like, neither of them were world travelers or writers, or, you know, they were both from small towns, had always lived in small towns, mainly in northern BC. And so, I mean, I used to sort of wonder if I was like dropped by a stork or something. But, you know, they were, my mom tells me now that when I had gone to Africa, a lot of people and, you know, her friends and stuff would say, oh, how could you let her go? Aren't you worried? And, you know, my mom's response was something like, you know, keeping her here or discouraging her from doing what she needs to do would be far worse than, you know, supporting her as she goes to live in Sierra Leone for a year. And, you know, we trust her judgment and we know she has a head on her shoulders. And so we're happy about it. You know, I think she sometimes had gritted teeth when she said that, but certainly that was the message I got. I mean, that they were ever even really worried is, you know, they told me years later after I got back. So that's, I mean, that's huge. And it wasn't a natural thing for them. And I just, yeah, I am so grateful to them for that and many other things too.
That's, yeah, that's so important. Jessica, a couple more questions. Just as far as, you know, listeners, you know, there's other aspects of your work within, investigative journalism and things you've written. Could you just kind of give a like a just a little bit of a like a summary of some of the other type of research in articles you've written in journalism?
I worked before setting off on working on the book. I was at the Toronto Star for a couple of years, and you know, a lot of that job was newspaper report, like pretty straight up newspaper reporting, but you certainly got the opportunity to, you know, we would say like write the hell out of something once in a while. And that was pretty great. And then prior to that, when I was in West Africa, I did some freelancing for the Star and for some other places. And, you know, it was largely features. Some was breaking news, but a lot, you know, features where you'd go and spend a lot of time with certain people and you would try and relay this really different world and really different lives to North Americans. And I did a lot of fiction and nonfiction there that was sort of based there. I mean, none of the fictions, a lot of the nonfiction hasn't been published either. And if I go back to it, I can see why. But yeah, it was really an exploration of a really different place and different culture and different history. And yeah.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I know you've done, I've looked on your website, you've done a lot of different work in your experiences. There seems to be a lot to it. I'm wondering if your experience answers the big question of the podcast of why is there something rather than nothing? Can you help me out?
You know, I don't know. And maybe it does sort of relate because I think it's one of those questions that is unanswerable. Everyone will have a different answer. There's different explanations. There's different beliefs. ultimately, it's always a mystery. And that's sort of the beauty. And that's sort of the parallel to what is truth and who are we and all these questions where it's a matter of perspective. And I think that the magic in the world comes from learning about perspectives and developing your own and coming to understand others. And so it would be terrible, actually, if this question was answerable. It's the quest to figure it out that actually becomes the meaning.
I really like your answer. I never answer my own question, but I will say that one of the things I like about Buddhist philosophy on this question, they just say, throw it out. Don't bother answering it. It's useless to look at. And I like that kind of dynamic to the question itself. And I think it's a great one. I really enjoyed your answer. Jessica, can you tell the listeners where they can connect with your book, with your material, what you would like to share with them so they can find you on your platforms?
Yeah, so I have a website, which is just jessicamcdermott.com, and it links to various work, and it links to where you can get the book. And I would just encourage everyone to go to their local bookstores, especially now, because Amazon's doing very well and local businesses are struggling. So please go to your local bookstore.
Yeah.
Or the library.
Or the library, right. I think I might have encountered your book through the library, and they lend out audiobooks because I listen to the book. Yeah, just thank you so much, Jessica. I mean, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And again, I want to thank you for your hard work and advocacy and your sharing of the story of the Highway of Tears. And also very excited to kind of connect this conversation to the next conversation with your friend and collaborator, Kim Gucci. But Jessica McDermott, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me and for the work you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Take care now.
You too.
Bye.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.